Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated June 3rd, 2011. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's front page, top of the fold, Roper's board seat pay $750,000, by Jason DeBruin, from Chapel Hill. Dr. William L. Roper, Dean of the School of Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, in 2010 was paid more than $750,000 for his membership on the boards of two publicly traded healthcare companies. Filings with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission show that Roper serves on the boards of Denver, Colorado-based DaVita Incorporated and Franklin Lakes, New Jersey-based Medco Health Systems. In total 2010 compensation, he was paid $483,949 by DaVita and $272,789 by Medco. In addition to his work as dean of the medical school, Roper is vice chancellor for medical affairs and CEO of the UNC healthcare system. His total compensation from UNC was $717,600 in 2010. DaVita is a Fortune 500 company that provides kidney care in the United States, delivering dialysis services and education to patients with chronic kidney failure and end-stage renal disease. Medco is a pharmacy benefit manager and operator of the nation's largest mail-order pharmacy operation. Two medical school professors are taking aim at the service of Roper and other medical school deans on the boards of corporations, saying such board memberships create the potential for conflicts of interest and should be fully disclosed to the public. They say Roper is one of only seven of the nation's 161 deans of schools of medicine to serve on the board of directors of healthcare-related public companies. Dr. M. Felix Freshwater, a professor of surgery at the University of Miami School of Medicine in Miami, and his son, David Michael Freshwater, a professor at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, wrote an article published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, a publication of the Journal of the American Medical Association, entitled, quote, "Failure by Deans of Academic Medical Centers to Disclose Outside Income," end quote. There is a need for substantial improvement in the ease of access, timeliness, and accuracy and precision when reporting or making available outside compensation information, the senior Freshwater said in an interview. It is something that is necessary for public trust. UNC representatives said Roper was unavailable for comment, but on his behalf, they said he has followed every disclosure policy at the university. He lists his board membership, but not on his compensation, on his biography page. Financial information about Dr. William Roper's outside income is public information and has been widely reported on numerous occasions, wrote David M. Parker, Associate Vice Chancellor and Deputy General Counsel for UNCCH, in an email. Quote, "His board affiliations are clearly disclosed on his website. However, disclosing compensation for these board positions in this venue has not previously been our practice," end quote. UNCCH is currently rewriting its financial disclosure policy, says Karen McCall, Vice President for Public Affairs and Marketing, and will unveil the policy sometime between July and October. Quote, "We are going to implement our policy of making sure that we are transparent as possible," she says. The authors of the journal article recommend that each medical school should have a publicly available website that discloses faculty compensation from the university, medical center, and outside organizations, and update that information annually. Just by the nature of a perceived conflict of interest when the dean of a medical school serves on the board of a healthcare company, that dean should take extra care to be transparent, Freshwater says. McCall says Roper's information is publicly available because his board pay is revealed in SEC documents. But such documents are voluminous, written by lawyers, and difficult to decipher by those inexperienced in digesting them. McCall says ease of access to information, not just a letter of the law viewpoint, will be a consideration as UNC's disclosure policy is reviewed. Quote, "That goes to the heart of most of these conflict of interest policies that deal with," end quote, she says. The freshwater professors will present their case at the June annual meeting of the American Association of University Professors. Bank could be in a buyer research, in a buyer search, by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Despite continued double-digit losses in the first quarter, shares of Norfolk-based Hampton Roads Bank, owner of the Gateway Bank franchise in the Triangle, have soared in recent days on speculation that portions of the troubled lender are on the block. Hampton shares, trading in at the 11.36 range on May 16, had more than doubled to $26 during the week of May 31st. The number of trades also skyrocketed from a low of 10,000 on May 16 to a daily average of over 77,000 over the next 9 trading days. It's a record that puts Hampton Roads on NASDAQ's largest percentage increase list multiple times over the past week, despite the bank's first quarter 2011 loss of $31 million. That came on top of combined losses of $208 million for all of 2010, as Hampton and Gateway managers were forced to contend with a large stack of problem real estate loans. Hampton, with about 26 branches, mostly in Virginia, acquired Gateway with roughly 30 offices in both states back in December 2008. Since then, Gateway, with 5 Triangle branches, has operated as a subsidiary. The current acquisition talk has included a potential deal that would decouple the old Gateway footprint. As to comment on the speculation, Douglas Glenn, chief operating officer and bank counsel, declined. Triangle-based Piedmont Community Bank Holdings, run by Raleigh banker Scott Custer, is currently seeking to win regulatory approval for its third North Carolina acquisition, that of Cary-based Crescent State Bank. Custer has said in the past that he is interested in acquiring banks in Virginia as well. Asked about Hampton Roads Gateway, he said, "It would be inappropriate for me to comment. We have been trying to stay focused on getting our Crescent deal done. Finishing that is our main concern." End quote. Attempts to reach representatives of another active regional bank acquirer, Charlotte-based North American Financial Holdings, or NAFH, for comment were not successful. Ken Engelke, chief economic strategist and banking analyst for Richmond-based Capital Securities Management, says he has been following the recent run-up in Hampton's share price and attributes it to a trio of factors. Despite the bank's recent troubles, he says Hampton Gateway has access to cash, banking talent at its helm, and an improving loan portfolio. Loans no longer repaying, for example, fell by 23% to $188 million for the 12 months ending March 31st. As for acquisition rumors fueling the run-up, Engelke, who does not own any Hampton Roads shares, simply says, "Well, we shall see." Still on the front page, at the bottom of the fold, partnership budget cuts may not be as severe as forecast. By Sugata Mukhei from Morrisville. The state budget pendulum may be about to swing in a positive direction for the Research Triangle, regional partnership, and other economic development agencies. The state Senate version of the 2011-12 budget calls for a relatively small 12% cut in funding for North Carolina's regional partnerships. In the last 3 years, that would mean a 30% cut to the partnership's budget, says Charles Hayes, CEO of the RTRP group that represents 13 counties in the Triangle. However, we're delighted that it was only a 12% cut. Ronnie Bryant, president and chief executive officer of the Charlotte Regional Partnership, had a similar sentiment. Quote, "This is a reduction that we can live with," he says, "but it's not certain that the state's regional agencies are in the clear yet as legislatures attempt to slash spending to fill a $2 billion plus spending gap." Hayes says his agency uses nearly 90% of its annual state infusion of about $500,000 to support marketing activities. Quote, "Marketing is a key component of what we do," Hayes says. At the Kinston-based Eastern Regional Partnership, state cuts would have forced a scaling back of the jobs development program, says CEO John Chaffee. The reduced cuts would go a long way in saving the jobs program and a few others designed to spur economic development, says Chaffee, who adds that 30% of Eastern's budget of $498,000 comes from government funding. The remainder comes from a trust fund that was created almost 20 years ago. Set up in the early 1990s, the nonprofit partnerships represent blocks of communities in branding and business recruitment efforts and in coordinating economic development activities, among other government and private agencies. The Senate's version of the state spending bill that was unveiled a few days ago allocated nothing to the partnerships. That would have meant the agencies would lose a total of $5 million in annual funding. In March, Governor Beverly Perdue's proposed budget sliced 50% of the partnership's recurring funding. The $5 million of non-allotment funding was not even addressed in her budget. All the back and forth is an exaggerated version of the usual budget wrangling, says Natalie English, the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce's chief lobbyist. Quote, revenues are a little bit up, but not enough to make up for stimulus funding and the temporary tax increases enacted in 2009, she says. The latest Senate budget bill calls for the partnerships to get $4.4 million from the state, down to $5 million. That would mean the private sector would be asked to ante up a larger share of RTRP's 2011-12 budget, Hayes says. The other option is to decrease our budget for the next year, he adds. Almost 20%, $320,000, of RP's money comes from the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. The agency also gets support from the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce. This funding model, which is different from some other regional partnerships, has worked for us in the past two decades, Hayes adds. The budgeting process is far from complete, though. Legislatures have until June 30th to agree on a budget bill and have it signed by Perdue. And the governor is pushing back against the General Assembly's cuts in education funding. This week's lead article at the front page of the Triangle Business Journal is The Saga of Greenfire. Company's plans for Durham elicit praise as well as criticism. By Monica Chin. From Durham. Greenfire Development, which has an ambitious vision for Durham's city center, has come under scrutiny lately, just as it's trying to embark on its biggest project to date. The developer faced a public furor after May 14, the day the roof caved in on one of its warehouses that was home to arts and nonprofit businesses. As a result, Greenfire's plans to turn the SunTrust Tower, the most prominent landmark in downtown Durham, into a 165-room luxury hotel and spa has become more important to the developer than ever. And the clock is ticking. Construction must start by July 31st for Greenfire to qualify for $4.2 million in city incentives, and the developer is hurrying to submit revised financial details to city officials. The new financial arrangement for the $55 million project involves federal and state historic tax credits covering about 40% of the cost, says Greenfire managing partner Michael Lemansky. The rest would be financed through a mix of debt and equity. Lemansky says a hotel management partner will be announced soon, and Greenfire is in negotiation with investors and lenders. Greenfire did away with plans to use $25 million in federal recovery zone bonds to help fund the project. Instead, the developer is looking into New Market Tax Credits, a federal program to help low-income communities. We've got the development agreement. We are confident that we will begin construction by the end of July, Lemansky says, of the SunTrust Tower. This project has always been a centerpiece of the transformation for the city center, he says. Before the recession, Greenfire proposed a $284 million master plan to redevelop the city center. And the SunTrust Tower was a key component, along with plans announced in 2009 for construction of a 150,000-square-foot office building at Parrish and Corcoran Street. The developer owns some 26 properties in downtown Durham and has gathered investors, most of whom are local, according to Lemansky, through 41 limited liability corporations. The total assessed tax value of the properties, according to Downtown Durham Incorporated, is $37.5 million. Since Greenfire began buying up properties in the early 2000s, however, it has only pulled the trigger on a few notable redevelopments. The Crest Building, which houses social entrepreneurship incubator Bull City Forward and a number of condominiums. The Baldwin Lofts, an apartment building that's been converted to condos. And Rogers Alley, a collection of three buildings near City Hall that has a mix of retail and office space as well as restaurants Dos Perros and Bull City Burger and Brewery. The Stahl and Greenfire's redevelopment momentum, combined with its ownership of so many properties in downtown, have combined to give rise to grumblings in downtown circles. Some say Greenfire skewed the downtown market and pumped up asking prices and rents by buying so much property. Others say the company is poor at managing the properties that have tenants. Much of that resentment burst out of the floodgates with the recent collapse of a large section of the 2.4-acre roof of Liberty Warehouse, a historic tobacco auction warehouse that housed tenants including Liberty Arts, a foundry that built the iconic bronze Durham Bull. Mike Waller, manager of Liberty Arts, has been an outspoken critic of Greenfire in recent weeks. Pictures of rotting beams inside the buildings have been circulated through websites, and Waller has commented on blogs, quote, "The building always had problems, but the former owner, Walker Stone, he always kept it up," Waller says. Greenfire would have no response at all, or their response would be basically, "If you don't like it, leave," end quote. A preliminary assessment of damages by Greenfire's insurer states that a poorly designed drainage system and long-term deterioration, quote, "invisible to the naked eye," end quote, between two sections of the warehouse were the cause of the collapse. A full assessment will be forthcoming in about 3 weeks. Liberty and other small businesses previously housed there have retrieved some of their belongings and moved, or in the case of furniture shop Southern Portico, closed. Greenfire also faces city scrutiny involving another building, a burned-out structure at 117 West Parrish Street, spanning from Parrish Street to Main Street that's missing a roof. Long-time reluctance by Greenfire's leaders to discuss the company's financial condition and plans for the properties have fueled complaints about the developer's role in downtown. Some property owners, retailers and businesses have voiced concerns about whether the developer has the financial wherewithal to pull off its grand plans. The public records paint the following picture. Greenfire took on debt of $29.6 million to buy eight prominent properties in its portfolio, which are the SunTrust Tower, also known as the Hill Building, Legacy Tower, which is home to the North Carolina Mutual Insurance Company, the South Bank Building at 40 West Main Street, Rogers Alley, Baldwin, Liberty Warehouse, 619-621 Foster Street Warehouses, and 609 Foster Street. Some of the properties were purchased at a discount. The Legacy Tower, bought with a $9.35 million loan in 2003, is now assessed at $11.3 million for tax purposes. Some of the properties were overvalued. Brain LLC, a Greenfire company and owner of 619-621 Foster Street, took on $1.2 million in debt to buy the buildings. The properties were last assessed at $720,846. The burned-out building at Main Parish was purchased for $330,000 from Tom Neiman, one of the developers behind the West Village in downtown, and a company that has faced its own financial difficulties in recent years. Starting in 2008, Greenfire began extending its loans. By 2010, the developer modified its loans on four of the eight properties and received higher interest rates. The Well, LLC, set up by Greenfire to own the South Bank Building, received a loan modification in September 2008 that turned a $2.48 million loan into a $3.64 million loan. The developer also faced a number of liens on Rogers Alley in 2008, some of which were disputes between contractors and did not involve Greenfire. More recently, Relevance Incorporated, a tech startup, moved out of Rogers Alley. Relevance CEO Justin Getland declined to comment. Greenfire is showing signs of shedding properties in Durham. In March, Baldwin Lofts apartments were converted to condos. The 108 Morris Street building in the Five Points area is under contract to be developed into a three-story restaurant. That sale is expected to close in August or September. Lemansky says the loan extensions and modifications have been positive moves to improve Greenfire's cash position. Quote, "We haven't taken out much debt in comparison to the building's value," Lemansky says. "Because of that, our cash flow has improved over the last year, given the down economy. We've done a good job of leasing properties. Our properties all have different loan maturity dates. We never have to refinance prematurely." End quote. Legacy Tower's loan increase was a result of improvements made to the building, Lemansky says. The building is now 90% occupied. The South Bank building is close to 90% leased as well, according to Lemansky. Bill Karkoff, president of Downtown Durham Incorporated, expressed confidence in Greenfire's ability to move ahead with SunTrust after meeting with Lemansky and others this week. Quote, "For Greenfire, this will be the biggest building they've ever done," Kalkoff says. "I think it'll go a long way towards stabilizing them financially, and it will go a long way in terms of giving the financial community and the commercial real estate community confidence in them. They clearly got caught up in the tough economic times." End quote. Greenfire's other properties have provided space to startups over the years, in particular to the Tiermark building, which is housed advertising agency Baldwin and Shoeboxed, a receipt scanning company. "They were a great landlord, very flexible. We would have stuck with them if they had a property that fit our needs," says Taylor Mingos, CEO of Shoeboxed. "Because of the deal they gave us at the time, it allowed us to stay in downtown Durham," she says. "Greenfire has worked hard to maintain that diversity so that everyone can afford to be in downtown," Lemansky says. "We recognize that other people would take a different approach and redevelopment properties into higher-end space. We want to continue to provide a diversity of options." Moving inside, past the front page, our next article is titled "University Square at Core of UNC Projects," by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Chapel Hill. When University and Chapel Hill town officials met last fall to talk about redevelopment of the high-profile University Square property on Franklin Street, they were greeted by a familiar name, John McColl, a top executive with the university's partner on the project, Atlanta-based Cousins Properties. McColl also happens to be a UNC alumnus and the son of retired Bank of America executive Hugh McColl, Jr., who has been a longtime supporter of the university and its Kenan Flagler Business School. John McColl says Cousins Properties is very bullish about the Triangle real estate market and is actively looking for investment opportunities in the region that would be an addition to the nearly $100 million redevelopment it is planning for the University Square property at 123 West Franklin Street. "We've been very pleased with the support we've received from both the city and staff and all the neighbors," he says. "People want to see this project go forward." An entity of University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill Foundation purchased the University Square property, as well as the adjacent Granville Towers student housing complex, from the Kenan family in 2009, and it chose Cousins Properties as its development partner. McColl says he plans to submit details of the redevelopment plan by the end of June. That will start the clock on a timetable that McColl hopes will enable construction to begin by late 2012. UNC will likely be taking a page from its neighbors at NC State University's Centennial Campus and negotiate a long-term lease with Cousins that would allow the University Foundation to maintain design control and possibly invest some of its own funds in the project as a joint venture partner, says Gordon Merklane, executive director of real estate development for UNC Chapel Hill. Quote, "We won't finalize the deal until we know what the town is going to allow us to do," Merkling says. "It's all to be determined," end quote. The University Square project so far includes plans to build multiple buildings to accommodate 38,000 square feet of retail space, 275,000 square feet of office space, another 80,000 square feet building that could be used for retail, civic, or office space, a parking deck, and 160 multifamily units that would be available for rent. Until then, the current tenants at University Square, which is 98% occupied, are being encouraged to stay. Time Out restaurant owner Eddie Williams says he was recently offered an opportunity to renew his lease in the building through August 2013. Quote, I've been there 33 years, and I'm hoping and praying they don't boot me, even during the construction, he says. Merklean says part of his goal is to inject high-class office and apartment spaces that are currently not available in Chapel Hill's downtown district. Quote, we see this as a way to breathe new life into downtown, he says. The development also would give Merklean more options when university research groups come to him with a need to lease off-campus office space. UNC Chapel Hill currently has about 60 lease contracts for 413,000 square feet of space in mostly older buildings and scattered around Chapel Hill for clinical and research groups working under grant provisions. There are no buildings, there are no plans to redevelop the Granville Towers buildings for at least another 10 years, he says, adding that renovations currently underway on the dorm rooms, hallways, and common areas should be finished within the next 2 years. Merklean's office is also an advisor on the future development of Carolina North, a 250-acre research campus that is envisioned to one day have a mix of corporate and academic research buildings, similar to NCSU's Centennial Campus. UNC officials are requesting funds this summer from the General Assembly to begin planning for Carolina North's first research facility, which is expected to be self-liquidating from rents collected from its tenant groups, he says. UNC Chapel Hill would also like to relocate its law school to Carolina North in the future. Quoting, over the next 3 to 5 years, I'd like to see the first public-private partnership research building, some graduate student housing, and get some momentum started out there again, Merklean says. Next up, RDU's land plan. Airport ponders how to develop some of 5,000 acres. By Chris Basden, from Morrisville. Raleigh-Durham International Airport's first major foray into commercial development has run into a significant speed bump, but RDU officials still plan to forge ahead with projects as a way to diversify revenue streams and provide more amenities for customers. The airport dipped its toe into commercial development in 2007 with the opening of a Sheetz convenience store on Aviation Parkway. The airport has been pleased with the performance of that facility, which pays $150,000 in annual rent. But RDU's efforts at building on that success hit a major snag recently when the airport opted to cut ties with a partner that was supposed to build a Burger King near the Sheetz. The airport worked with Prospect Foods LLC in Charlotte for about 18 months on a plan to construct the fast food restaurant at the aviation station site, which includes the Sheetz location and two other lots. RDU has spent more than $2 million installing basic infrastructure on the entire site, including planning, roadwork, extension of the water and sewer system. RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamblin says the airport decided to stop working with Prospect in May because it was unable to obtain the necessary funding for the $1 million project. Quote, the company completed design and started the permitting process but could not finish, Hamblin writes in an email response to questions. Continuing the quote, it is our understanding that tightening in the loan arena made it difficult for Prospect to secure a loan. We enjoyed the relationship with Prospect, but in the end reached a point where we had to move forward with the project, end quote. A Prospect official could not be reached for comment. RDU is looking for a new partner that could open a fast food restaurant on the site and also wants to find a partner that can build a casual dining restaurant on the third lot. The project is important, and not only because of the money that RDU has poured into the site, but also because it is a test case of sorts for a new strategy that many airports are undertaking. Quote, I think more and more airports are looking at developing landside, says Debbie McElroy, an executive vice president at the trade organization Airports Council International North America, referring to commercial operations not located on the airfield. There's ample financial incentive to do so. The airline industry is notoriously volatile, and diversifying the non-aeronautical revenue streams can have a stabilizing effect during times when air travel is in a down cycle. Of course, there's also a downside to development as well. Airports might step on the toes of private developers. Even worse, just like those private developers, airports run the risk of investing in developments that end up failing. Airports typically stay away from residential development due to concerns about noise. RDU, for instance, owns 5,200 acres of land in a large part to act as a noise buffer. McElroy says developments surrounding airports can range from office parks to hotels and even to pet hotels and golf courses. RDU Business Development Officer Ingrid Harrison says airport officials haven't specifically studied building a golf course or a hotel, although the airport had a hotel that operated near the terminals from 1965 through 1996. It closed to make way for a parking facility. While airport officials are tight-lipped on specifics, work already is underway that could point the way for future development. RDU is in the process of conducting a land use study that will determine the best spot for a consolidated rental car facility. That same study also will consider what commercial development opportunities are there for other tracts of land at the airport. Quote, "We will be looking at the opportunities that are compatible with the airport environment," says Harrison. And now, as backers defend tort reform, Cooper doesn't step back. By Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper has come out swinging in his opposition to tort reform legislation being considered by legislators, saying such a law could cost the state millions of dollars and leave residents unprotected from bad drugs. The legislation, House Bill 542, states that, quote, "No manufacturer or seller of a product that is a drug shall be held liable in any product liability action," end quote, if that drug was approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Cooper says the law would bar his office from doing its job in criminal investigations. Quote, "It makes no sense to tie our investigators' hands at this time of growing health care costs and shrinking state budgets," he says. The measure passed the House on June 1 by an 85-32 vote, with 19 Democrats joining the mostly Republican supporters. Representative Jonathan Rhine, a Lincolnton Republican, is the bill's primary sponsor. "Sometimes side effects are truly unforeseeable," he argues, "and the manufacturer should not be held liable in that situation. If the pharmaceutical manufacturer did everything right, then there is not going to be any liability, nor should there be," says Ryan. Critics, in addition to Cooper, perceive the legislation differently. Dick Taylor, CEO of NC Advocates for Justice, predicts serious ramifications to North Carolinians in a report titled House Bill 542, An Attack on Innocent Citizens, A Gift to Corporate Wrongdoers, end quote. Quoting Mr. Taylor, "If this bill is enacted, manufacturers in other states will be able to dump their dangerous and defective products in North Carolina with impunity." Mike Rothrock, an attorney with the law office of Leone Noble and Seat, says only Michigan has a similar law, and it directly costs the state an estimated $20 million in Medicaid claims because the state was barred from taking part in a $4.85 billion settlement with Merck and Company over the drug Vioxx, which was proved to double the risk of heart attack and stroke. It is this aspect that has Cooper especially critical. In the past decade, the Medicaid Investigations Unit in his office has recovered more than $400 million, including numerous pharmaceutical settlements, says Cooper. Among them is a recent $44.3 million settlement with drugmaker EMD Sereno, following allegations that the company paid doctors to prescribe its products. North Carolina's share of the settlement came to $760,000. Before passage, June 1, Ryan added an amendment to make it clear that a drug manufacturer can still be held liable if that manufacturer knew of dangers, improperly marketed a drug, or sold a drug after orders to remove it. Also, the protection applies only after the FDA has approved a drug. Additionally, Ryan said, quote, "In Vioxx, I'm told Merck did some misleading things to get the approval," end quote, something that would disqualify a drug manufacturer from any immunity. Quote, "If the company does everything the company was supposed to do," end quote, it would receive legal protection, he says. Pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline supports the legislation, saying it would enhance the state's competitiveness and retain and add jobs, according to Mary Ann Rhine, a a GSK spokeswoman. Drugs must still pass the FDA process, she says, and provide risk warnings. Other supporters include North Carolina Representative Daniel F. McComas, a Republican from Wilmington, says patients who think they have a malpractice suit too often use a shotgun approach and seek compensation from a variety of payers, something he sees as an abuse of the system. Next up, Sears Stone, Ask Judge for Assist, by Lee Weisbecker, from Cary. An Atlanta group that wants to build a continuing care retirement community in Cary, called Sears Stone, has asked a judge for help in its effort to win state approval financing for the 169-unit development. The North Carolina Medical Care Commission, which oversees such projects, in November shut down an application from Samaritan Housing Foundation, Incorporated, for a $112 million tax-exempt bond package to build the project. Given the economic environment, the commission ruled the idea seemed too risky. Samaritan, in response, began looking elsewhere for financing, but behind the scenes appealed the Medical Care Commission's ruling and is asking Administrative Law Judge Melissa Owens Lassiter to overturn it. With its project denial, Samaritan's Raleigh attorney, Marcus Hewitt, argues in filing that the commission, quote, exceeded its authority, end quote, acted, quote, erroneously, arbitrarily, and capriciously, end quote, depriving the project developer of property rights and, quote, greatly increased the financing cost, end quote, for Sears Stone. In response, the Medical Care Commission sought to have the appeal dismissed, which Lassiter denied May 23rd, directing both parties into mediation, pending another hearing, says Vicki Bullock of the State Office of Administrative Hearings. Eventually, the issue could end up in Superior Court. Jim Jones, a spokesman for the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, in which the Medical Care Commission is housed, declined comment. Quote, it's a matter of litigation, which renders it inappropriate for comment, he says. Hewitt says the appeals process could take more than a year to complete, but that his client is determined to see it through. Quote, Samaritan believes it qualifies for bond financing from the commission, he says. As the legal tug-of-war has continued, Sears Stone backers have been pushing ahead with the project, pre-booking units, which would be constructed on a 24-acre parcel at High House Road and Davis Drive, if financing is found. The funding alternative Samaritan settled on following the commission's negative vote was the Wisconsin-based Public Finance Authority, PFA, a less than one-year-old entity set up to sell so-called tax-exempt conduit municipal bonds in all 50 states. In the case of Sears Stone, PFA agreed to market a bond package of $125 million if pre-bookings demonstrated enough interest. The Wake County Board of Commissions signed off on the alternative. PFA's website says the group has issued bonds for a total of six projects since January, ranging from schools to apartments to utility company facilities. Its biggest deal so far was $24 million. Bonds for two of the projects received high AAA ratings from Standard & Poor's. Two others received A2 ratings from Moody's, putting them in the upper middle of the risk scale. The remaining two got ratings of BBB, minus and BB plus from Standard & Poor, meaning that the packages have, quote, adequate, end quote, investor protections, but with elevated risk levels during a troubled economy. Lowered rate or riskier bonds generally require higher investment payments to bond payers. The links between PFA, a similar California-based bond issuing authority, and its investment partner, HB Capital, recently with the focus of an LA Times story. The story reported that Los Angeles County supervisors had ended their relationship with the California Bond Authority, quote, over concerns that the agency's credit standards weren't strict enough to protect bondholders or its government clients, end quote. To date, PFA has sold bonds in for eight financing transactions, the largest being $113 million. As to the issues raised by the newspaper story, authority spokesman John Pencower says that the group stands by the credit quality of its bond packages. Quote, this is a very successful model, Pencower says. Not knowing Not known is how much less costly medical care commission financing would be compared to the PFA deal, or what would happen on the financing side if Samaritan ultimately wins its appeal against the commission. Hewitt, Samaritan's Ernie, says he couldn't discuss those matters. And now it's time for A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen, Storer funnels profit to Alzheimer's research. In September 1999, 2 months before her mother died after living with Alzheimer's disease for 12 years, Laura Gaddis opened a 1,400-square-foot thrift store in Fuquay, Varina, with the idea of generating funds to support Alzheimer's research. The following year, Gaddis applied for and received nonprofit status for the organization, Grody and Angel Thrift, which in its first 10 years raised $1 million. And last summer, the nonprofit's board set a goal of raising $1 million more in 5 years. Quote, "All my net profit goes to Alzheimer's research each year," says Gaddis, an Apex native who retired after a career as an insurance agent with the Alabama Farm Bureau to help care for her mother a year before she died. Guardian Angel donates the money it raises to Alzheimer's North Carolina, which uses the funds to support Alzheimer's research in the state. Gaddis is, quote, "one of the most committed individuals I've ever known," says Alice Watkins, executive director of Alzheimer's North Carolina. "We have been working and promoting together to make people aware of Alzheimer's and to raise funds for Alzheimer's research." In an annual budget of just over $1 million, Guardian Angel operates the thrift store and a sister store, Little Angel Home Goods, that sells donated clothing for children and adults, as well as furniture factory overstocks. The two stores, both in Fuquay Varina Shopping Center, employ 48 people, including 10 to 15 who are seniors or people who otherwise might have a tough time holding a job. The agency also works with volunteers, including individuals performing mandated community service. Guardian Angel's thrift store sells a broad range of donated items, although it does not accept mattresses or large appliances. Guardian Angel, which provides on-the-job training for employees, generated another $200,000 in 2010 that was donated to Alzheimer's North Carolina. This year, 80% of the funds will be used for research grants, with the remainder to fund a program at Alzheimer's North Carolina that offers respite care and training for caregivers who work with Alzheimer's patients in their home. The respite program has special meaning for Gaddis, whose father was the sole caregiver for her mother until he died in his sleep. Quote, "I saw what Dad went through with Mom," she says. "She was like a shadow to him. He was caring for an adult body with a child's mind. It is so demanding for caregivers." End quote. Guardian Angel has been a family affair for Gaddis, who serves as executive director. Her daughter, Sherry Gaddis, serves as district manager. Gaddis's sister, Martha, and Gaddis's late husband, Dave, formerly served on the staff. More than 170,000 people in North Carolina are affected by Alzheimer's, a number that is expected to quadruple by 2025, according to Alzheimer's North Carolina, which serves 51 counties in North Carolina from the Triangle to the coast. It provides family support, community education, and public awareness, and supports research for the prevention, cure, and treatment of Alzheimer's disease and related disorders. Next up, After Extended Swoon, Cost for Road Building Edging Up, by Chris Basden, from Raleigh. As bad as a Great Recession has been for the North Carolina Department of Transportation's top line, it has had at least one beneficial side effect. Prices for road construction have been on the equivalent of a fire sale, with bids regularly coming in 10 or more percent below NCDOT estimates. Unfortunately for NCDOT, but fortunately for construction companies, that's beginning to change. Quote, "Prices have rebounded," says NCDOT Chief Financial Officer Mark Forrester, "though it's far from a full recovery." End quote. In 2010, for instance, low bids came in 15% less than engineers' estimates, and during the first 4 months of 2011, prices were just 9% lower than NCDOT projections. NCDOT officials point to the nascent economic recovery as a major reason for prices going back up. Foster expects that while there still is going to be a gap, at least until the health of the U.S. private construction market improves more, it won't be as big as during the heart of the recession. As for the construction companies, they've been working to squeeze every ounce of profit out of every job they get. George Marsh, president of local contractor Gelder & Associates, estimates the pre-recession profit margin for road construction projects was in the range of 5% to 10%. That dropped to 3 to 4% during the slowdown and its aftermath. Some firms may have gone even lower in the 1 to 2% range, Marsh says. As for any recovery, Marsh says that, so far, it's just materials and fuel costs that have been increasing, not profit margins for road builders. NCDOT data illustrate the benefits that lower construction bids meant for the state. 1. In 2007, low bids on all 189 of the centrally let projects totaled just over $1 billion. That was $34 million, or 3.3% less than the engineer's estimates by NCDOT. 2. A year later, low bids on 229 centrally let projects were nearly $190 million, or almost 11% below the engineer's estimate. The savings got even higher in 2009, $202.4 million, or 17.7% under engineers' estimates. There were good reasons for such cheap work. The downturn knocked a kink in the world demand for fuel and construction materials, which caused prices to decrease. At the same time, contractors found themselves with very little private work to bid on. That led many more firms to go after public work. Quote, "We were getting intense competition and bidders we hadn't seen in a while," says Victor Barber, the administrator of NCDOT's Technical Services Division. "We were about the only game in town," end quote. NCDOT has tried to take advantage of the trend by getting as much work on the street as possible, and savings from cheaper projects were poured into other projects. Next up, after 35 years, Sisters Burnett, ready to sell and move on. Co-founder of catering company says she has a new business venture that she wants to focus on. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh. The owner of one of Raleigh's oldest catering services, Sisters Catering Company, has stopped taking reservations into 2012 and is searching for a buyer for her Millbrook Road event and catering facility. Sandra Burnett, who co-founded Sisters Catering with her sister, Betsy Benning, in 1976, has decided to either sell the business or shut it down by the end of the year so she can focus her attention on a new business venture, the H-Card fundraising program. Quote, "I'm smart enough to know I can't give 100% two times," says Burnett. Continuing, quote, "For over 35 years, I have been developing my entrepreneurial skills, faith, and vision, and it takes all three. At this crossroads, I feel prepared to move into the national arena and really make a difference to others," end quote. Burnett, a self-described entrepreneur who is always working on her next big idea, in 2007 teamed up with a couple of other entrepreneurs from Texas to form Schoolheart Incorporated. Schoolheart has since evolved into the H-Card program, a show and save discount card used by participating local and national merchants for cardholder discounts and other incentives. It will also be launching its own smartphone applications later this year and will be available to military members and veterans across the country. More than 75% of the proceeds from sales of the $20 cards benefit a participating school, nonprofit, or charity organization such as USO of North Carolina. John Falconberry, president and CEO of USO of North Carolina, says the USO has begun marketing the H-Card to its volunteers and supporters as a way to raise money to support its services across the state. Quote, "It's not the panacea for all our fundraising requirements, but it's a good opportunity," he says. Burnett notified her sister staff early in the year to stop booking events that were planned after December 2011. She says she would consider remaining a limited partner or consultant to the business if the buyer agrees to keep all her staff members, many of whom have been working at Sisters for more than 20 years. She says she has 4 full-time employees and some 30 part-time employees, a number that is down from a year ago after Sisters ended a 21-year catering relationship with the Women's Club of Raleigh. Her first priority, though, is finding a buyer for the 12,000-square-foot event facility with a plantation-style porch and grand white columns that she had built at 2400 East Millbrook Road in Raleigh in 1997. The 3-acre property also has a 4,000-square-foot patio, a garden, and waterfall, and parking for 190 vehicles. Burnett says she has invested $35,000 in renovations to the facility since January, including new carpet, paint, door trim, and additional landscaping. Burnett is asking $2.4 million for the property, which is the assessed tax value of the property, according to Wake County records. Burnett says she'll relocate the H-Cart operations to a nearby flex facility she has used for storage of event equipment in the past. This week's guest column is from Andrew Broad, addressing a subject that was never answered in my time in economic school many years ago, understanding the role of inflation. Pop quiz. Are you ready? Imagine a world in which the only thing affecting consumer prices is the price of oil. Now suppose that price shoots up to $200 per barrel over the next week and stays there forever. Suppose also that the economy absorbs that price rise by increasing many other prices within a few months. Based on this scenario, is the following statement true or false? A year from now, inflation rate will be high. False. Yes, prices in this imaginary world will be higher due to the high price of oil, and inflation will rise while prices factor in the effects of expensive oil. But in my scenario, that process will end within a few months, after which there will be no need for further price increases. By a year from now, prices will have stabilized. So the statement is false because inflation is about price changes, not levels. If prices are stable, whether high or low, we have no inflation. Inflation happens only when prices are rising. My imaginary world is actually quite relevant to the economy right now, given how concerned people are about commodity prices. Thanks in part to political uncertainty in Libya and other oil-producing countries, prices rose from about $90 per barrel at the end of 2010 to around $110 in early April. Strong growth in emerging economies like India and China didn't help. The result has been fear of renewed inflation among many economic commentators, but these fearful pundits would have failed my pop quiz. Commodity prices can cause a sustained inflation only if they keep rising. If they rise to a point and stay there, let alone rise and then fall, the implications for inflation are short-lived. This is why commodity prices have much less effect on inflation and much less relevance for monetary policy than people believe. This is one of the many reasons, but we'll have to cover the others some other time. Commodity prices are extremely volatile. They fall through the floor as often as they shoot through the roof. Oil prices are back under $100, and their effect on inflation is already diminishing. The confusion between changes and levels isn't limited to prices and inflation. It shows up in how we describe the business cycle. The U.S. economy has been in an expansion for nearly 2 years, though no one outside the hugely profitable financial sector would call these good times. But expansion doesn't mean things are good. It just means they're getting better. Similarly, recession doesn't mean things are bad, just that they're getting worse. The economy was stronger in early 2008, when we just entered a recession, than it is now. Many important economic indicators are expressed as rates of change, and this can complicate how we interpret them. The 2009 fiscal stimulus is a case in point. By late 2009, it appeared that the benefits of the stimulus were already disappearing. It was adding less and less to the growth of gross domestic product. But stimulus spending wasn't decreasing. It continued to grow well into 2010 before it started to decline. It was, however, growing more slowly. So even though the stimulus added more to the level of GDP in 2010 than in 2009, our focus on GDP growth made it look like the reverse was true. Growth rates are important tools for understanding the economy, but like all statistics, they have their limitations and sharp edges. Handle with care. Triangle Business Journal, Biz, has long thought a bike parade should be combined with a beer festival and carnival. Lucky for us, Tour de Fat is coming to downtown Durham this year. The event is put on by New Belgium Brewery, the Colorado-based brewery of brands like Fat Tire, and celebrates all things bicycle while raising money for local nonprofits. Participating bikers will parade through downtown Durham, then join up at the American Tobacco Complex for more entertainment. The Tour de Fat will be June 25th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. and include a costumed bicycle parade, New Belgium beer, eye-popping entertainment, and local food, along with bizarre bike contests and much, much more. The Tour de Fat is free and open to the public, with proceeds from beer and food sales and donations going to charities, including the Triangle Spokes Group, which provides bicycles and helmets to children of low-income families. Riding in the parade is open to anyone, with registration beginning at 9 a.m. at American Tobacco. Costumes are encouraged, both for bikes and onlookers. At every stop, Tour de Fat looks at least one person to trade out his or her car for a bike for one full year and is seeking volunteers from the Triangle to make the commitment. Habitat for Humanity has become one of the most popular hands-on volunteer opportunities across the globe, and one local company for the past year or so has stepped in to do the heavy lifting. Since early 2010, Raleigh's Southern Crane has helped install roofs on 21 homes for Habitat for Humanity of Orange County. To understand what a major help this is, consider that a crane can lift three 600-pound triangular roof trusses that have already had roofing materials in place each day. By comparison, a 300-pound truss without materials in place requires 8 or 9 strong men working all day. Habitat Construction Director Tyler Momsen-Hudson says, having the help of Southern Crane is a blessing and a great savings for us in time and effort. Southern Crane's Earl Johnson III says, we are proud to be part of this wonderful cause. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.triangleradioreadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.